The sudden resignation of Joshua Wolf Shank as director of UNLV's prestigious Black Mountain Institute literary program set off a buzz of speculation in the local creative community. The Los Angeles Times has reported that Shank left his position after accidentally exposing himself during a Zoom meeting with colleagues. Through a public relations representative, Shank said he regretted taking a bath to relieve some nerve pain, this during a virtual meeting with BMI staff, and he did not think that the camera was on at the time. We talked about Shank's resignation back in April with John L. Smith, who is here to fill in some of the details. John, welcome back.
It's good to be back, Joe.
John, the LA Times piece does clarify some of the speculation about Shank's resignation, and this is at one of the nation's most high-profile literary institutions. Has there been any fallout?
Well, the fallout has been, kind of building in the wake of his resignation. The mystery that surrounded it, sort of. I mean, there was a lot of very well-sourced speculation about why he left, but there was no one on the record. And yes, I mean, after the LA Times story, you know, Twitter really lit up from here to Timbuktu about it. A lot of criticism of what took place and of the story itself, because there were some holes in it, and some sympathy for Shank as well. But you know, it's really an unceremonious way to leave an institution that is really highly regarded.
Yeah, Shank arrived at Black Mountain Institute in 2015. What was he known for there?
Well, you know, to start with, he was known for his energy. He was a very peripatetic guy. He had a lot of big ideas. Some of them came to bear. Some of them did not. He was a disruptor of the status quo there. You know, Black Mountain did not need to be established. It already was established as this really nationally and some would argue internationally respected literary institute with an awful lot going for it. And he really came in as this kind of dynamic new idea man there. And he had some accomplishments. They added the Believer magazine. They added a festival, the kind of new generation attractions that are popular with some folks. But it also got, you know, hipper but thinner. You know, the stays for the major writers that used to last months at a time were reduced to weeks. The stipends that attracted them were reduced as well. So there was some criticism along the way. However, he had really one of the best jobs in kind of literary culture, certainly here, but maybe even nationally.
And you mentioned he was executive director of Black Mountain, but also editor-in-chief of Believer magazine. He held other titles at the university. What about his influence on the magazine? What was seen there?
Well, you know, he was really kind of the cool master there. He basically got to shape the direction of the magazine. It was considered a place where some writers wanted to be published. And there are those magazines out there that are designed to provide, you know, really alternative views and new literature and kind of groundbreaking thought and ideas. You know, the Believer was struggling when it was purchased and brought to UNLV or to Black Mountain. And out of that idea grew the idea for Believer Festival and something where you know, it wasn't merely having something published, but then almost really performing it. Remember, Shank was an early founder or at least contributor to the Moth Radio Hour, and so he was very much performance oriented as well as writing oriented.
And Believer Festival really became something that got on the radar nationally in 2019. The New York Times story with the Believer Festival in the background held Las Vegas up as a, quote, literary hub. Now, that festival didn't happen last year because of the pandemic. Is it supposed to be back this year?
Well, I'm not sure. And that's something that certainly the university and BMI could clarify. Right now, I have a feeling the earth is moving under their feet a bit after this resignation and the fallout. So there may be some more changes. Clearly, there have been some recently. So, you know, we'll have to see just what BMI looks like going forward, whether it becomes kind of a more traditional literary institute, you know, that had a lot going for it to start with, including the City of Asylum program, which was really wonderful, or whether it goes down this same road of a kind of new generation of literary style.
So is this episode at BMI with Shank, is this an embarrassment for BMI and the UNLV, or how would you characterize it?
Well, I mean, it's a huge embarrassment, first of all, not only for the principal party who's now departed, but for BMI itself. This is a really proud institution. I mean, I want to say that, you know, former President Carol Harder and Beverly Rogers, who have their name on this institution officially, they put a lot of time, effort, a lot of their credibility, as did so many other people. My wife, Sally, once worked at BMI, and so for a couple of years, I had a view of it and saw some really dedicated people who were, you know, proud to grow this message of a literary Las Vegas, you know, bringing in Nobel Prize winners and best-selling authors and people of great note in the poetry community. I mean, you're really talking about a winner, and there'll be some repair work to do, I suspect, but, you know, it's a worthy enterprise, and it'll be worthy going forward.
You know, anytime somebody in a position of power or higher up resigns, there are always people on Twitter who are going to attack, and we've seen that in Joshua Shank's case, but there are also people coming to his defense. What are they saying?
Well, you know, some of the people coming to his defense have their own Twitter followers, and they're writers who know Josh Shank and know his track record, I guess, in the literary community. So he definitely has, you know, his defenders or people who are at least preaching and calling for some sympathy here, that there's this, perhaps this was some kind of mistake, or, you know, just a feel for a guy with fibromyalgia. You know, so he does have some supporters there. However, if you were balancing this mathematically, there are far more critics out there. A lot of folks stepped out. Some of it was pretty gratuitous, really going after him for some of his style in treatment of people while he was at UNLV. And so, you know, you've got both sides certainly up in arms over this.
BMI was the beneficiary of some $20 million from Beverly Rogers. As we hear it, the money has largely been spoken for. This nonprofit still wants donations. Do you think this kind of incident will impact the potential to get those donations?
Well, it certainly has to be, you know, like an unforced error here. you know, this is a real challenge, whether this chills current contributors and, you know, really benefactors of BMI or not. You know, it's not the kind of news that goes away in a day. However, in its context, as long as BMI moves forward with the kind of quality that we've known from it in the past, you know, I think that that's all good on BMI. It does raise some questions, however, about whether UNLV itself and whether BMI itself should have been more forthcoming about this. Remember, this is a program that in very recent years under Shank's leadership courted a very high profile. It courted the New York Times. This literary institute really splashed nationally and made a big name for itself. So in credible fairness, there should have been probably more transparency until we, of course, wind up reading about it in the Los Angeles Times.
So do you think that's where the story goes now, talking about how BMI should move forward?
Well, I think so. But, you know, these kinds of things don't generally occur in a vacuum. So, I mean, there's going to be some criticism of Shank and reason for criticism. And so as they move forward, people will also want to know whether this was a pattern of activity or just some really dumb, really, really dumb thing to do. We'll see how it goes.
Let's go now from the resignation of Joshua Shank as head of Las Vegas's well-known literary institution to a new book about Las Vegas. This book is called Becoming America's Playground, Las Vegas in the 1950s. It's by Larry D. Craig. What makes this different than so many other books that we've seen over the years on similar topics?
Well, you know, this is one of those things that if you love Las Vegas, the nostalgia, and with its own sense of history, Larry Gregg is a historian who has a really clear-eyed view of this. He's a very meticulous researcher, and he covers a lot of ground, a whole decade basically and more in this book, which is less than 300 pages. It's a lot of fun to read. Some of the stories, of course, those who are interested in this topic will know. However, he brings a lot of close scrutiny to different things, everything from the way blacks were treated in Las Vegas in that decade, the way women were treated in that decade, and of course the great hotels that sprung up and how they did and that sort of thing. So it's well worth your time, that's for sure.
Well, how does he handle women and blacks in that decade, the 1950s?
Well, you know, it's straightforward. The fact is women were objectified like nowhere else in the country in Las Vegas in that decade and beyond. And blacks were second-class citizens, not only in that decade, but also well into the 1960s. The civil rights movement, seeing it come slowly to Las Vegas, seeing it be rejected by some power brokers in Las Vegas, as well as, you know, women making strides, however small they were and marginalized they were, using women for a cheesecake, essentially, over the fact that they might contribute to actually running a casino or running the town.
Of course, there has to be something about the mob. The mob was very influential then. What does he say about that?
Yes, this is a very straightforward treatment of organized crime's influence in Las Vegas in the 50s. Remember, this was an era when the lieutenant governor of the state had a piece of the action at the Thunderbird. So this is, you know, the intermingling, and I think this is really the story of Las Vegas and Nevada gambling, the intermingling of politics and organized crime is really the story of Las Vegas. And I think Greg does a very credible job covering that.
I almost hear a jump in your voice talking about this. What is it about the 1950s that was so special in Las Vegas or that you see as special?
Well, this is the part that I probably love the most about the 50s Las Vegas. It's the promotion of the town, this kind of unabashed, you know, hucksterism that took place about the town. A man named Steve Hannigan was key. He should be on everyone's walk of fame in Las Vegas history. You know, they really promoted Las Vegas to try to counterbalance a lot of the bad news, you know, in parentheses put mob activity and ownership. A lot of the bad news and a lot of the moralizing that America had about Las Vegas, they had promoters, you know, people like Stan Irwin and Harvey Dietrich, Herb McDonald, Al Freeman, the floating crap game, and of course, Miss Atomic Bomb. No discussion is complete without that. you've got all of that going on, and all for a reason. They're trying to promote this place that a lot of America just cannot comprehend, a gambling center in the middle of the desert in a state that no one really wanted. And it's blooming and blossoming and attracting the Hollywood crowd, and attracting all kinds of critics, of course, who all go to Las Vegas just to check it out, wink, wink. You know, there's a lot of that goes on in this book, and it's a fairly belt and suspenders history, but it covers that era, and that's my favorite era.
John, before we go, I want to talk about Dan Rodheimer. He's the failed candidate for Congress who lost to Susie Lee in Nevada last fall. Now he's a failed candidate for Congress in Texas. What happened?
Well, he came in 11th. I think that, you know, that's and that's the show. No, actually, you know, he was a newcomer. He cut an advertisement that really, I think, came back to bite him. You know, he affected riding a bull and getting bucked off and getting back up again. And then he winds up stepping in a cow pie. Who knows what that was about? But Dan Rodheimer, he brought a lot of energy in a kind of a carnival sense to Congressional District 6. Which was actually is now in a runoff situation after 23 candidates took a shot at it. Two Republicans will run, and we'll find out in a few weeks who prevails and fills the seat in Congress. But, you know, Rodheimer was a professional wrestler, and he's a big man and a flamboyant guy. And so this is one of those things where I think he just took a shot because he was fairly competitive against Susie Lee in Nevada. And now he's a Texan. I have a feeling he might be back in Nevada soon. Who knows? He's originally from New Jersey, so the cowboy hat really didn't fit him to start with.
Why do people keep running for office?
Oh, I think that there's a celebrity factor of politics that is underappreciated in American culture. I think a lot of these folks, you know, I don't want to say that they're not well-meaning, although I don't think they're all that well-meaning. I think that they're all in it for the vanity. And this is one of those examples where, you know, perhaps Donald Trump needs a big fanboy like a Dan Rodheimer. But the reality is that, you know, if he had started in a slightly smaller office, like, you know, he might have had more success. But again, it's really about catching the moment and the ability to fundraise. And Rodheimer has enjoyed that. Whether he'll enjoy it going forward, who knows? But, you know, there again, there's 48 states left.
John L. Smith is a long time. Yeah. Try every state. John L. Smith is a longtime journalist in Nevada and commentator for State of Nevada. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
This is State of Nevada.